else you'd like to add to the people out there? Peter Tork and Tad from Shoe Suede Blues.
Yeah, whenever asked, I always say, be a hero to yourself.
You can also get our product at blackdrawers.com. Blackdrawers.com.
Also, shoesuedeblues.com.
Well, from the Skagit Valley County Fair, it's Nardwuar the Human Serviette signing off saying, doot doot a loot doo. Peter Tork, doot doot a loot doo.
Six bits.
No, let's try that again.
Tunes, go for it.
I'm not a tune.
Peter, doot doot a loot doo. Thank you very much, Peter Tork and Tad from Shoe Suede Blues.
Are you following me? Are you chasing after me? The dolly is backing up.
Hey, listen, I told you to leave us alone. How many times I got to talk to you like this?
I'm sorry, well,
leave us alone, pal. We got a private life, all right? You know, some things are public, some things are private, but you know what? Sometimes you just got to leave a fella alone, you know, because...
What about Tutu-Lutu? What about Tutu-Lutu?
Oh, walk out, girl, don't you walk out, we've got things to say. Talk out, let's have a talk out, things will be okay. Say, girl, I don't want to fight, I'm a little bit hard, and you're a little bit. It's a little bit too. I don't know just what I said, because I apologize. I don't know, here's where you belong, wipe those tears from your eyes. Say, girl, I don't want to fight, I'm a little bit wrong. And you're a little bit right. Well, I say, girl, you know that it's true. It's a little bit mean. It's a little bit true. True. I don't want to find, I'm a little bit wrong, and you're a little bit right. Well, I'll say that, you know that it's true.
Today is Friday, November 25th. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on the internet.
Right here on News 101. What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more for anyone to have. Here I am, here you are. Take it slow for now. Here I am, here you are.
Good evening, it is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from around Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Mass demonstrations continue for a fifth day today in Egypt, with hundreds of thousands of protesters crowding Cairo's Tahrir Square. International media report at least four more people have been killed in clashes between protesters and security forces. Yesterday, military head Mohamed Hussein Tantawi remained firm in his refusal to immediately pass power to a civilian government, as protesters demand.
We will stick to the timeline of parliamentary elections followed by presidential elections in June 2012. And then the military will return to its barracks, but only if the people want and only through a referendum.
Audio and translation from Al Jazeera. Today, the UN Human Rights Commissioner said she deplored the military's use of rubber bullets and sometimes live ammunition as excessive force. The military is also using gas against protesters, but exactly what type of gas has recently been questioned. Protester testimony indicates some gassings have caused more severe side effects than others. Canisters recovered from the scene show at least some of the gas comes from a U.S. firm located in Jamestown, Pennsylvania. The Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry today issued a scathing report accusing state security of using excessive force and torture against demonstrators. This summer, residents of the small country launched anti-government protests demanding the ouster of King Hamad al-Khalifa. At a press conference today, Khalifa said the officials responsible would be held accountable for their actions, but the government denied the actions against the protesters were institutionalized policies. In Senegal, the military says separatist rebels have killed at least 10 villagers in the unstable southern region of the country. FSRN's Alpha Jallo has the story.
The men were found near the small village of Janyo in the restless Casamance region. The Senegalese army has already blamed Casamance rebels for the carnage. Army spokesman Colonel Aboubakarin Kebe told journalists that the slain civilians were walking in the jungles when they were attacked by fighters on Tuesday afternoon. The men were logging fuel wood for commercial purposes. The separatists, known as the Movement for the Democratic Forces of Casamance MFDC, have been waging a low-intensity insurgency against Senegal's government since the early 1980s, although attacks have declined in recent years. Rebels want independence and control of forest resources. But the rebels have not claimed responsibility for the attacks. Instead, they condemn the killings and call on the Senegalese authorities to track down the perpetrators and bring them to justice. Alpha Jallo, Free Speech Radio News, Senegal.
Activists clashed with police in Normandy, France today as they temporarily blocked a train carrying high-level nuclear waste to a storage facility in Germany. FSRN's Liam Moriarty has more.
Tear gas filled the air as an estimated 400 activists did their best to stop the train as it passed through the town of Valognes in northern Normandy. Despite an estimated 3,000 police on hand, several groups of activists managed to damage track and signaling equipment, making it impossible for the train to pass. A van was also set on fire. Yannick Rousselet heads the anti-nuclear campaign for Greenpeace in France. Greenpeace did not officially participate in the action, but Rousselet was there. He describes the scene via cell phone.
In front of me, at something like 80 meters from me, I am on the bridge. I can see that there is a deformation of the rail. The demonstrator removed the stones which were under the rail, and after that they used some kind of hydraulic system to deform the rail.
Several arrests were reported, and two protesters and a police officer were slightly injured. After crews repaired the track, the train finally left Valonia nearly 4 hours late. The train's troubles aren't over yet. Tens of thousands of activists are expected to greet the train when it arrives at its destination in Gorleben, Germany. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber said Tuesday no more prisoners will be executed while he is governor. Voters reinstated the death penalty in the state in 1984. Two executions have been carried out since then, but the pending execution of convicted murderer Gary Haugen prompted Kitzhaber's announcement. The state's other two executions happened under Kitzhaber's former terms as Oregon governor, but the physician said he could not allow it to happen again.
Those are the most agonizing and difficult decisions I have ever made as governor, and I have revisited and questioned them over and over again for the past 14 years. I do not believe those executions made us safer. Certainly, I don't believe they made us more noble as a society. And I simply cannot participate once again in something that I believe to be morally wrong.
Kitzhaber did not commute the sentence of Haugen or any other inmate on death row, but he called on the legislature to reform the system he calls expensive and unable to meet the basic standards of justice. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, and these are your local headlines.
24 hours after Occupy Vancouver relocated to the Robson Square Courthouse complex, protesters packed up their new tent city and moved to an East Vancouver park after a judge granted the province an injunction yesterday to remove the new Occupy camp at the court complex. BC Supreme Court Justice Anna McKenzie gave the protesters until 5 p.m. to leave the area as she found the group to be a public nuisance and in contempt of the court. But McKenzie declined to give the province a blanket order that would have prevented protesters moving the encampment to other city public lands. I do not think it to be the court's jurisdiction to issue an injunction for something that has not occurred and is speculative, she declared. Occupy Vancouver volunteers wasted no time complying with the court order as they packed up tents and loaded structures onto a moving truck hours before the deadline. The protesters now have camped at Grandview Park on Commercial Drive.
The Chief Justice of BC's Supreme Court, Robert Bauman, has issued a rare call for his colleagues to speak out against the funding cuts that he says threaten the province's entire judicial system. Bauman's comments to the BC branch of the Canadian Bar Association follow similar criticisms by provincial court judges, other Supreme Court judges, and even BC Court of Appeal Chief Justice Lance Finch in the last few years as the bench has become increasingly vocal about the government's legal policies. Premier Christy Clark said despite a significant economic crunch, her government is taking steps to improve the situation. She said the government has also sought to reduce demands on the system, pointing to changes in family law and BC's drinking and driving laws, which she said helped to divert matters from the court when possible. Bauman said the court services budget will be reduced by more than 10% between 2008 and fiscal 2012-13, a cut that he said, quote, translates directly to a reduction in staffing levels. He said staffing shortages at court registries have meant delays of up to 6 months in the processing of court orders, which he says impedes access to justice for litigants. He added that government programs that support the justice system are also not funded to a level at which they can provide, quote, meaningful assistance.
BC Ferries passengers traveling on major routes will pay more for their tickets when the fuel surcharge rises from 2.5% to 5% on December 12th. This increase is being imposed because of higher costs to buy marine fuel. The company expects its fuel costs will hit more than $120 million in the 2011-2012 fiscal year. The three major routes between Vancouver Island and the mainland will see the surcharge rise to 5% from 2.5%, a BC Ferries release said Friday. A surcharge of 2.5% is coming into effect on the Horseshoe Bay-Langdale route. Minor routes where the surcharge is already at 5% will not see an increase. No surcharges are in place on the Port Hardy-Prince Rupert and Prince Rupert-Haida Gwaii runs.
A batch of new women-only emergency shelter beds will be available in the downtown East Side next week. Operated by St. James Community Service Society, the shelter located at 329 Powell Street opens Monday and will provide 26 beds as well as meals and support services for women. The shelter itself isn't new, said Jonathan Oldman, the SJCCS's executive director, explaining that the shelter has been closed awaiting renovations. When it closed, the shelter's beds were shifted over to another location at 626 Powell Street, which is where they will stay. The Community Service Society has operated for 50 years and currently offers 52 beds for single women at Powell Place, located at 625 Powell Street in the downtown East Side, and an additional 32 beds for women and children at the St. Elizabeth Home in Mount Pleasant. BC Housing is providing the funding, but it's not clear yet how much it will cost, he said. It's expected to operate until at least March 31, 2011, and will help homeless women get through the winter. Over the last two winters, the province has provided an additional $1.5 million to fund 160 emergency severe weather shelter spaces in Vancouver.
Those are your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Liveband.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. Liveband.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit LiveMusicVancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. Liveband.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the national and international news.
This Thursday in Halifax, a meeting of provincial health ministers under pressure to control spending dismissed a call for higher taxes to pay for expanded health care. Nova Scotia Premier Daryl Dexter rejected a national coalition's call for tax increases to strengthen the system and ensure stable funding. The provinces are bearing too much of the overall cost of healthcare, Dexter said. Provincial and territorial health ministers say the rate of growth in healthcare spending is not sustainable. But as governments grapple with pressure to reduce deficits, the public is becoming anxious about the loss of healthcare services. Nova Scotia Health Minister Maureen MacDonald, who is chairing the meeting of ministers, said the healthcare system needs to reflect a growing demographic, a growing population of elderly people. Maude Barlow of the Council of Canadians told a news conference in Halifax that healthcare coverage should be broadened to include pharmacare, continuing care, and dental care. Barlow also said Ottawa should commit to a 10-year health transfer plan with the provinces that would see the 6% annual increase continue. She said the Canadian Health Act must also be enforced to stop private health care services from eroding the system.
Protesters at the Occupy Montreal site tied themselves to a tent as one last stand against their imminent eviction from the Victoria Square encampment, which authorities shut down on Friday. Nine people tied themselves to the kitchen tent in the square and chanted at the police, who eventually ripped down the sides of the structure to move protesters out. The full-scale eviction comes one day after protesters were given a second notice that they had to vacate the square. Protesters watched from the sidelines, chanting and jeering at police. They did not interfere with the operation, however, and no arrests have been reported. The protesters had been negotiating with the city and hope to be able to remain for one more night in advance of a rally set for Saturday.
New economic reports state that the buying power of Canadians' paychecks is eroding as wage gains fail to keep pace with inflation at a time when domestic spending is key to countering the effects of a deteriorating global economy. Wages are growing at the slowest rate in nearly 2 years, new figures from Statistics Canada show, as the most populous province grapples with a weak job market that is making it more difficult for workers to demand pay raises. Meanwhile, the spike in global commodity prices that started in the spring is translating into unusually high energy and food costs.
Average weekly earnings in Canada are highest in Alberta, while Saskatchewan has moved up quickly, Stats Canada numbers showed Thursday. At $906.22, weekly earnings in Saskatchewan in September were higher than in Ontario for the first time, and well above the national average of $872.75. The decline in the factory sector is a key reason why the Canadian economy shed a surprising 54,000 jobs in October, the most since February 2009 in the depths of the recession, and the jobless rate edged up two notches to 7.3%.
Those were your national headlines, and now it's time for the international news.
Portuguese public workers went on strike Thursday against the austerity measures, shutting down much of the country's public transportation and services. The tens of thousands who participated in Portugal's 24-hour strike on Thursday, including air traffic controllers in Lisbon, said the austerity measures cut too deep. The austerity measures were put in place by the government in order to secure an EU and International Monetary Fund bailout of $105 billion in an attempt to stabilize the economy and buoy up the failing euro. Workers are protesting what they feel are too strict of measures, but Prime Minister Rolo said the main issue is to stave off the financial crisis. It is up to me to mobilize the Portuguese for action every day to contribute to transform Portugal, he said, according to Reuters.
There has been a recent outbreak of cholera in a northern Kenyan refugee camp due in part to heavy rains, which have caused flooding and road closures, making fresh water and food more difficult to deliver. Officials at the Dadaab camp suspect the outbreak originated from new arrivals who likely picked up the disease in Somalia or en route to the camp, and that because of the road closures, many people have resorted to consuming contaminated water. So far, there are 50 suspected cases and one death. Cholera treatment facilities are being established to treat the more extreme cases.
More strikes have erupted in Shenzhen, southern China, as thousands of workers from the Jingmold Electronic Company walked off the job early Tuesday morning to protest unreasonable overtime arrangements. The crowd, which was attempting to block one of the major roads, was quickly dispersed by hundreds of anti-riot police. One worker told the Epoch Times that the main reason for the strike was low wages and long overtime. Many said that they often worked until midnight. The hourly overtime payment on a normal day is 150% of the regular hourly rate, but the rate increases to 200% on weekends and 300% on holidays. Mexican activists have asked the International Criminal Court to investigate President Felipe Calderon over the torture and killing of civilians in the war on drugs. A petition signed by more than 18,000 people also asks the ICC to investigate Mexico's most wanted drug lords, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. The Mexican government has denied the accusations of crimes against humanity. It says its security policy cannot constitute an international crime. Human rights lawyer Netze Sandoval filed a complaint with the ICC in The Hague, asking it to investigate the deaths of hundreds of civilians at the hands of the security forces and drug gangs, as well as alleged torture and rape. Mr. Sandoval told Reuters news agency that, quote, "The violence in Mexico is bigger than the violence in Afghanistan and bigger than the violence in Colombia. More than 40,000 Mexicans have died in drug-related violence since December 2006, when President Calderon began using the military to combat the drug cartels. These deaths include a growing number of civilian casualties."
The protests in Egypt continue as citizens call for an immediate transfer of power to a civilian government. Field Marshal Mohamed Hussein Tantawi said the military government would be prepared to step down if the Egyptian population called for this in a referendum. However, the crowd was even more incensed after the speech and were doused in tear gas. Over the past 5 days, over 38 people have been killed, thousands have been wounded, and 15 journalists attacked. For more on this, we'll go to a clip from Democracy Now! To hear their report from a Democracy Now! Correspondent in Cairo.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh.
Thank you, Amy. And welcome to our viewers and listeners around the country and around the world.
Hundreds of thousands of protesters continue to fill Cairo's central Tahrir Square despite an announcement by Egypt's ruling military council to accelerate the timetable for transferring power to an elected government. Over the past 5 days, security forces have killed dozens of protesters and injured thousands as Egypt has witnessed the largest protest since the fall of Hosni Mubarak. In a televised address on Tuesday, the head of Egypt's military council, Field Marshal Mohammed Hussein Tantawi, said he had accepted the prime minister's resignation and that the military was ready to relinquish power if that's what the Egyptian people call for in a referendum.
I have taken the following decisions. I have accepted the resignation of Prime Minister Essam Sharaf's government and for it to continue working until a new government that will hold all powers is formed. This will allow it to manage the transitional period in coordination with the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. The parliamentary elections will take place on time, and electing a president will be complete before the end of June 2012. The Armed Forces, represented by its Supreme Council, do not aspire to govern and place the country's interests above all. It is ready to immediately hand over responsibilities and return to its main responsibilities of protecting the nation, if the people wish, and could be carried out through a national referendum, if the situation would call for one.
That was Mohammed Hussein Tantawi, the head of Egypt's ruling military council. Protests intensified after Tantawi's speech, and security forces unleashed a barrage of tear gas across parts of Tahrir Square. The effects of which could be felt at the far edges of the square and beyond. Meanwhile, the U.S. issued its strongest statement since the latest round of protests began. This is State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland.
The United States remains very concerned about the violence in Egypt. We condemn the excessive force used by the police, and we strongly urge the Egyptian government to exercise maximum restraint, to discipline its forces, and to protect the universal rights of all Egyptians to peacefully express themselves. While all parties in Egypt need to remain committed to nonviolence, we believe that the Egyptian government has a particular responsibility to restrain security forces and to allow the Egyptian people to peacefully express themselves.
Reports from the El Nadeem Center, an Egyptian rights group, said late last night that at least 38 people have been killed and more than 2,000 wounded nationwide since Saturday in the military government's crackdown. Some of the dead were reportedly killed by live ammunition fired by Egyptian forces. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, has called for an independent probe into the killing of demonstrators. We go now to Democracy Now!'s Sherif Abdelkaddous. He's been in Egypt since the revolution erupted in January and has been closely following the latest crisis on the ground this weekend. He's been in Tahrir Square for the last days. Sherif, welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about the reaction to Field Marshal Tantawi's address.
On national television yesterday and spoke, as you mentioned, in the lead. And he essentially offered some minor concessions that were not demanded by any of the protesters in Tahrir. As you mentioned, he offered to move forward presidential elections to June of 2012, said they would only relinquish power in a referendum, even though they didn't come to power in a referendum. And other statements. He also, the tone was somewhat threatening at times, defensive and threatening. He said that any criticism of SCAF would be seen as an attempt to topple the state. And he also said that the Supreme Council has acted with self-restraint despite mounting criticism over these last 10 months, despite reports, of course, of torture and the jailing of 12,000 civilians through military trials. The response, and many compared this speech to Mubarak's second speech on February 1st, where he made some kinds of concessions and used this kind of tone in the hope of ending the revolution. But the response then and the response now were very similar. Tahrir yesterday was packed with people, really a massive, massive protest. And after the speech ended, you heard this huge reverberation from the crowd, this huge echo of Erhan. Rihal, which means leave, the same language that was used in the 18-day uprising. And also the people demand the toppling of the marshal, referring to Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi. So I think the speech was, again, too little too late, and didn't go anywhere to placating the protesters' demands. And as you mentioned, just moments after the speech ended, while there's been clashes going on the outskirts of Tahrir for now 5 days, we've passed 100 hours of continuous clashes. But most of the time within the square itself, it's pretty secure. It's actually a strange dichotomy to be in the square. People are selling food, and there's almost sometimes a festive atmosphere. But at the same time, you see wounded people being carried by, and just 30 yards or maybe 50 yards away, there's tear gas and guns and violence and blood and rocks. But what happened after the speech was an attack of tear gas that hit the square itself. Very, very strong. It cleared half the square. I was on actually a 9th floor balcony of a friend's apartment that overlooks Tahrir, and it cleared the balcony of people. That's how strong it was. And so, you know, he makes the speech, and then the police attack. So I don't think it went far enough at all.
And Sharif, in addition to the attacks on protesters, there were also reports of attacks on journalists. Can you say a little about that?
That's right. In the past few days, as these protests have happened, at least 15 journalists have been attacked. The journalist syndicate staged a march yesterday in protest of that. 10 of them in Cairo, 5 of them in Alexandria that were attacked. One in Alexandria was arrested, taken to a police station, stripped naked and beaten for 5 hours. The head of the journalist syndicate has threatened to halt publication of all newspapers in protest of this. And there's also the attacks in general have just not stopped. It's really surreal that this has been going on for so long, these 5 days now, or we're in the fifth day of these attacks. I just walked over, and it's just absolute bedlam at certain parts of the square. The tear gas is extremely strong. And yesterday, it seemed they're almost using a new type of gas that most of the time you can see this white plume of smoke, but this time you didn't see anything, and all of a sudden your face would burn, your eyes water, and your throat would—you wouldn't be able to breathe. So this has been going on for quite some time now. And the Supreme Council just actually issued a statement on statement number 83, denying the use, well, saying that the armed forces didn't use any tear gas. Of course, technically that's true. The police are the ones that are using the tear gas, but it's them trying to distance themselves from the violence that's been happening under their authority for the last 5 days.
Sharif, Amnesty International is also saying they've received reports from medical sources saying some of those who've died have died as a result of asphyxiation after inhaling tear gas. Also, Democracy Now! Correspondent Anjali Kamat, also in Cairo, sent this horrific photograph of people dragged to the corner who look like they are dead, certainly unconscious, heaped with just dragged to the side where there's garbage. The number of people who have died, Sharif, and what you think this means for Monday, the parliamentary elections, and the demand for the future now. Tantawi saying they will hand over to a civilian government next July. Where does all this lead?
Well, the number of dead, the Nadeem Center, as you mentioned, puts it at 38. And as we spoke about yesterday, I went to the state morgue, and the technician there said that 23 of the bodies that he had received had died because of live ammunition. So these attacks continue, and that picture that you refer to is actually part of that video where I mentioned where the attack on Sunday, where they cleared the square temporarily before retreating, people who had fallen as a result of either being shot or stampeded or just falling over and lay unconscious were dragged by military police and left in a pile in garbage. Very clearly this was done. So this is the type of violence being used against protesters. With regards to the elections, Tantawi yesterday pledged that they would indeed take place on November 28th, which is just 5 days away. I think it's very difficult to see how they can have real legitimacy while this is happening in Tahrir. A number of candidates, parliamentary candidates, have suspended their election campaigns in solidarity with the protests. Significantly, the Muslim Brotherhood has not. Significantly, the Muslim Brotherhood did not take part in yesterday's protest, which I believe was the biggest protest so far of this revolution without their participation. It was one of the biggest protests so far of the revolution, period. So I'm not sure exactly what will happen with the elections. They may go ahead as planned, but it remains to be seen how they can have real legitimacy while this massive uprising is taking place and has no signs of abating yet.
Well, Sharif, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Sharif Abdelkadous, Democracy Now! Correspondent, reporting from Cairo. And, of course, some of those tear gas canisters that we've seen people holding up say CS on them, CS being Combined Systems, which is made in Jamestown, Pennsylvania. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, a highly unusual story.
That was a clip from Democracy Now!, where they heard from their correspondent in Cairo talking about the protests at Tahrir Square and the Egyptian people protesting against the Egyptian military. So, continuing with our international news, India promised on Friday that plans to open its vast retail sector to global supermarket chains would create 10 million jobs after the cabinet approved the long-awaited but controversial reform. The changes would push India further towards a modern consumer society, but they are loudly contested by opposition lawmakers who fear large supermarkets such as Walmart and Tesco will kill small family-run stores where most Indians now shop. The government plan will open up the sector, worth an estimated $470 billion in annual sales, to allow Walmart, Tesco, and other global firms to hold a 51% stake in multi-brand retailers. Foreign multinationals have lobbied for years to sell directly to consumers in the world's second most populous nation. Multi-brand foreign groups now operate as wholesalers in India, but cannot sell directly to the public. Currently, family-run stores account for 90% of the sector, the second largest employer after agriculture in the country, of 1.2 billion people.
Arctic sea ice is disappearing at a rate unseen in the past 1,450 years, says a Canadian study published Wednesday. The amount of ice has been continuously declining over the last 4 or 5 decades, but this past summer almost 50% of the Arctic ice was lost. This is in part due to the fact that there is less snow and ice buildup during the winter months, and thus a larger percent is melted in the summer. As well, thinner ice after the summer means that it takes longer to build up that thick winter ice. The ice in the winter is much weaker now than it was 60 years ago. The implications of this are great. Many Inuit communities rely on the ice for their way of life, and the dwindling polar bear population is facing starvation as their environment literally melts away. However, with the melting of more Arctic ice, opens up the area to greater tourism opportunities, oil and gas exploration, and shipping routes. Those are your national and international headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
We'd like to take a moment to thank businesses who have made generous donations to FundDrive 2011. Thank you to Fortune Sound Club, Lotus Land Tattoo, and Sanitary Electric Tattoo Company for helping us continue to provide quality alternative programming from 2011 and into the future.
We'd also like to thank our volunteer sponsors, Bilo Foods and Ethical Bean, for keeping our volunteers sated and caffeinated.
We here at CITR cannot do without your support, so thank you. If you'd like to donate to CITR's Fund Drive 2011, call 604-822-8648. That's 604-822-8648. Or go online to citr.ca/funddrive today. Get up, stand up, get up.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Up next, we'd like to play a clip from a panel discussion that was hosted by The Nation magazine and The New School in New York City this Thursday. The panel featured Oscar-winning filmmaker and author Michael Moore, journalist Naomi Klein, the best-selling author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and Rinku Sen of the Applied Research Center and publisher of Color Lines, and Occupy Wall Street organizer Patrick Bruner, and last but not least, the veteran journalist and author William Grider.
New politics and possibilities of the movement against corporate power. We hear first from Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, then Oscar award-winning filmmaker and author Michael Moore. The event's moderator was Nation Magazine's Richard Kim.
Isn't there some point, right, where this movement makes the demand and engages the state? And so, Naomi, I want to start with you specifically about climate change, but then maybe we could loop it back to Michael and just kind of go down the line on that question of what this movement's relationship is to the federal government or to the state.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what this movement's relationship is, but I certainly believe that we do need strong state action and strong state intervention. But at the same time, I think that the kinds of action that we want from the state can systematically devolve power to the community level and decentralize it. I mean, that's what's exciting about all of these examples, with economic localization, community-based renewable energy, cooperatives. What they share in common is that they decentralize and devolve power. And I mean, by their very nature, I mean, renewable energy, if you compare it with fossil fuels, you know, it's everywhere. That's the point. That's why it is less profitable, because anybody can put a solar panel on their roof and have energy. And that's why there's such momentum against it from corporate America, because they want huge centralized solutions because they're way more profitable, which isn't to say that you can't make a profit. You just can't make a stupid profit. You just can't. And so I think, you know, if we look at what there's so much outrage over, it is that concentration of power, that vertical power. And so, yeah, I do think the solutions have to disperse power, but that we won't get there without very strong intervention, national, international, local. And, you know, what I argue in the piece, as you know, is that I think that the right, the reason why the right is denying climate change now in record numbers, there are parts of this country where 20% of Republicans don't believe, 20% of Republicans believe climate change is a hoax. Sorry, 80%, 20% believe it's real. So you have this complete split where 70 to 75% of Democrats and independents believe climate change is real, and almost no Republicans believe that it's real. And so why is there this ideological split? If you listen to the climate change deniers, they believe this because they have looked at what science demands. They've looked at the level of emissions cuts that science demands, 80% or more by 2050, and they have said, you can't do that within our current economic model. This is a socialist plot. We would have their entire ideology, which is laissez-faire government, a tax on the public sphere, privatization, cuts to social spending, all of that, none of it can survive actually reckoning with the climate science. Because once you reckon with the climate science, you obviously have to do something. You have to intervene strongly in the economy. You have to invest massively in the public sphere along the lines that I was just talking about, these huge investments in infrastructure. But at the same time, just because you're investing in infrastructure doesn't mean that you can't say that the transit system should be accountable to the people who ride it, right? Because I think that you know, this has been one of the great failures of the left, is not understanding that state power can be just as alienating and just as corrupt as corporate power. And we have to have learned those lessons of the past.
I mean, similar question to you, Michael. You've made about the most compelling case for single-payer healthcare that I could imagine. You know, why isn't that a demand that Occupy Wall Street should make? I mean, what is that? You know, what do you see that role of this movement in fighting for these things that will require, you know, massive federal government intervention?
I think that'll happen. I think we're watching we're in the infancy of this movement, and it will grow, and that will happen. I have no doubts about that. I think the majority of the people in America would like that, and healthcare. In the same way that Naomi was talking about the environmental issues in terms of how that impacts the economy, I just think this is all going to happen. But I And you can play this tape back in about 2 years, because this is going to move very fast. This is one of these things where, you know, the part of the discussion we're having tonight is, you know, trying to figure it out. And I think Malcolm Gladwell's point was well taken in his book, The Tipping Point, that you can't create a tipping point. It just happens. And people have tried to figure out how to do that, and they go put their marketing head together, and it doesn't work. So I think that if I remember the Adbusters call, one of the things that they said was that the movement had to have one demand: just come together with, just get together in the park, and then come up with one demand. And that was such a crazy idea. It was like, it would have killed the whole thing. It would have absolutely killed it. Because they're so frightened about this movement now. I mean, the Republican debate last night, it was brought up two or three times. The Republican presidential candidate, one of the candidates had to say, I'm part of the 99%. I'm for the, I mean, they're even using the language now. They're so frightened by this. Bank of America had to get rid of their $5 debit card fee. They're like, they're running so fast. They don't know. Because they created this, you know, they created all the pain and suffering because it's their boot that's on the necks of the American people and the Canadian people and most of the people of this world. It's that they know that they feel now that people want that boot off of their necks. And you're, when you say there's 400 that have more than 150 million, but they only have 400 votes. And that just has got to, every night when they go to bed, go, holy, this is like, there's 150 million of them, and there's only 400 million of us. Well, we can buy candidates. Yes, we can buy candidates. I know, but we can't go in the booth and put our hands on everybody's lever. I know. Okay, well, we'll feed them a lot of nonsense on TV, and that'll get them afraid. And we'll make their schools, like, so crappy that they'll be ignorant and they won't know when we're trying to manipulate them with fear. And that's, you know, this is how we'll do it. And I just wish I could be in their bedrooms tonight. They're just, many of them are in Connecticut and they're not far away. If anybody's watching, I would just love to just be in one of their bedrooms tonight. Just what they just have got to, they're just so got to be so frightened by this.
Occupy Greenwich.
Because it's, well, it's our, as long, you know, our Bill is so right. You know, Bill has been such a warrior for trying to keep the bare threads of our democracy that are still there intact, that there aren't many left. We are really just hanging on by a few of these threads. And if one of those threads is one person, one vote. And so they can't really do anything about that. And we can, you know, you can say, oh, they can buy the votes. But listen, to take our lessons, you mentioned all the previous movements and historical implications of this. I mean, the women's suffrage movement that started in this state, in the 1840s, imagine the mountain that they had to climb. You know, people didn't sit around going, oh, how are we going to get this amendment passed? Because we can't vote. I mean, seriously, no woman was ever going to be able to vote for their right to vote. I mean, that must have seemed like the most impossible task. So what's great about this movement is, what's great about this movement is that we have to get out of our victim role. You know, this is why the concept of occupy, because occupy until 7 weeks ago was really a dirty word because we knew what it meant. Those lands that are occupied by us in the Middle East, the West Bank and Gaza by another country, you know, I mean, it's like, that's occupation. Occupation is a dirty word. And you have taken this and you've just, all of us, everybody's a part of this. We've turned it completely on its ear. And now we've owned the word. And it's not like, well, what are we going to do? You know, it's like, no, we've occupied you now. We've occupied the Washington Post. We've occupied the Wall Street Journal. And that's how this is going to go. But I just please want to second what Naomi said, that this is the no kidding around moment. Don't, my friends, please, the ship has sailed in. The ship will leave. As Bill said, many of these things that have happened in our 200 plus year history have failed or been crushed. And this is our moment. This is the moment for it to happen. It will only happen if every single person in this room tonight, when you leave and you go home, you have to say to yourself, what am I doing? What can I do to be part of the occupation? What am I going to do to occupy Wall Street? Everybody watching this at home, on the nation's website, anybody watching this right now, every one of you, it doesn't matter, you're living in Boise, you're living in the most faraway reaches of upper Minnesota, no matter where you are, I've seen Occupies that are two people big. This is where it's got to start. And it always starts that way, right? I mean, Marx, yeah. He just had Engels. They were just, that's all he had. I mean, it was like, they were just two old farts sitting around keeping their hands warm over the fireplace in London talking to each other. And they, you know, they came up with this idea. And JC had 12 Fisher guys. Look what happened with that. Whoa. So if you're at home and you're watching this and you're in some out-of-the-way place, you already own it. This is already your country. You have been occupied by Wall Street. Your homes have been occupied by Wall Street. Your government has been occupied by Wall Street. Your media has been occupied by Wall Street. And it's okay for you to say, not anymore. Those days are over. End of story.
Michael Moore, the Oscar award-winning filmmaker, his latest book is Here Comes Trouble, and Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. The evening's moderator, Richard Kim of The Nation magazine. And that does it for our special broadcast. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Ryan Devereaux, Dina Guzder, Manal Khan, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Nick Gillick, Hugh Grant, Jessel Noor, Jessica Lee, Vestica Dars. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
That was a clip from Democracy Now! Featuring a panel discussion that was hosted by The Nation magazine and The New School in New York City this Thursday. Featuring Michael Moore, Naomi Klein, Rinku Sen, Patrick Bruner, and William Grider. Those were the international headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
How do you write a good magazine article?
Discorder is that magazine published by CITR 101.9 FM. In it, you'll find reviews of concerts and albums, stories about bands and artists, comics, and more, including a comprehensive guide to CITR's programming.
In November's issue of Discorder, read up on the features, including interviews with Catherine Calder, Siskiyou, and the fabulous Vacant State. This month's venues column tackles Vancouver's queer hip-hop scene. And you can't miss that cover story on Blackout Beach. So look out for the deep red hue of November 2011's edition of Discorder.
Discorder is available all over the fine city of Vancouver. For a complete list of distribution locations, why not go online to discorder.ca.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to News 101. Next on News 101, we're going to go to Free Speech Radio News in a segment where they discuss a group of lawyers and journalists who are following allegations that the federal government has led a coordinated effort against Occupy movements throughout the United States. For more on that, we go to FSRN.
After a series of police crackdowns on Occupy Movement sites across the U.S., civil rights groups, attorneys, and journalists are seeking information on what they call a possible coordinated federal government response. This week, the National Lawyers Guild and the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund filed a Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, request for federal agencies, including the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the CIA. But the efforts bring up the difficulty of obtaining records under FOIA, which was designed to make government more transparent to the public. For more, we go to journalist Jason Leopold. He's an investigative reporter and deputy managing editor with truthout.org, and he's been pursuing information on the FBI and the Occupy movement by using FOIA requests. He's gotten some responses. Jason Leopold, welcome to FSRN.
Thanks so much for having me on.
First, in your FOIA requests to the FBI, what information are you specifically requesting?
Well, this was a FOIA request that I had filed October 31st, and in that FOIA request, it was a wide range of documents. I have been seeking emails, memos, transcripts, audio, any threat assessments, basically any email traffic or any traffic that has gone back and forth between FBI officials and local law enforcement and local government officials with regard to Occupy Wall Street. I do want to note that I also had made a FOIA request. I filed a FOIA request on the same day with Department of Homeland Security as well. And on actually on Monday, I received a letter from the FBI in response to my FOIA request. The letter was dated November 15th, so that's about 2 weeks after I filed it. And their response to me, surprisingly, was that they have not found any documents responsive to my request. And I truly find that to be surprising and astounding, to say the least.
Well, also in an article this week in truthout.org, you mentioned that at least one member of the FBI's cybersecurity team in New York received emails about Occupy Wall Street. That you know appears to constitute a document that would fall under this FOIA request. Why wouldn't that be included?
Exactly. Now, that's a very good question. So this is a member of the New York cyber security team, and this was a person who was the recipient of emails from an individual who had gained access to an Occupy Wall Street listserv. So my FOIA request went directly to FBI headquarters. And under the, it's at least my understanding that some of the changes that were made under this administration meant that when you file a FOIA request with FBI headquarters, that they're supposed to search, you know, at least conduct a broad search, which includes field offices. And, you know, my instinct is that it did not, and it was just isolated to, you know, the central record system. But this is, you know, again, this has long been a problem with the FBI in terms of they make it very difficult to find relevant records based on their search process.
President Obama came into the office pledging to speed up the FOIA request process. But 3 years later, and this is from March of this year, fewer than half of the 90 federal agencies had made changes to their FOIA process. So from your own personal experience as a reporter, have you found that the information has become more difficult to obtain under FOIA, or has the situation remained the same?
In my experience, and I'll tell you that in the past couple of months, say since September, I've probably filed more than two dozen FOIA requests with the CIA, with the FBI, with the Department of Defense, for a wide range of documents related to, you know, the past administration. I have not seen any difference. This administration has made many promises on transparency, and FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, was the restrictions were tightened by John Ashcroft, former attorney general, and Obama came in, signed this executive order, and those restrictions were loosened, but it's still it does not go far enough. We're still seeing this administration fight, in some cases, the release of documents. And you know, that's not to mention the fact that they're backlogged, and that's understandable in terms of the response time. But transparency is not exactly what we're getting here.
Jason Leopold is an investigative reporter and deputy managing editor with Truthout.org. He's been pursuing information on the FBI and other federal agencies and the Occupy movement by using FOIA requests, and we'll continue to follow your reporting on this. Jason Leopold, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Oh, welcome back to News 101 here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. That was our program for today, November.